Welcome to the podcast for Healing Neurology, where we talk about everything that can help heal your neurology, which is really everything from food, lifestyle, and medicine to nature, culture, and politics. There's no topic too big or too small. I'm Jillian Ehrlich, family nurse practitioner, certified in Ayurveda and functional medicine. And we have the one and only Dr. Eileen Ruhoy, board certified neurologist, PhD in environmental toxicology. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes. Yeah, I think people forget about my PhD sometimes and just think of me as a neurologist. I think my PhD is important only in the sense that, you know, environmental toxicology is sort of everything that we're exposed to. And I think a lot of what we do certainly is about what happens to us from years of cumulative exposures from things in our environment, which are toxins, contaminants, chemicals, infectious, stress. You know, so I think that my PhD often plays a role in how I see and approach patients. So that's why I like to bring it up. It's not about my accolades, really.
But it's amazing because it seems like there's a gap between neurology and toxicology, but there's not really.
There's
a lot of toxins that are direct, like neurotoxins. Like that's the basis
absolutely.
Of a lot of our chemicals.
That's absolutely true. And I think that we underestimate the role that our environment plays in our neurology and our illness and our health.
Yeah.
And, you know, we often talk about our environment, meaning in the home we live and, you know, our lifestyle choices, which certainly that plays a very large role, as we both know, and we definitely address those issues.
Mm-hmm.
We forget the larger environment around us, which plays just as an important role.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes more important, because sometimes there are exposures that are directly toxic and directly damaging and directly cause inflammation, even from just, you know, a short amount of exposure. So I think the environment is an important piece of who we are and how our bodies behave.
Pretty fascinating. And today, our topic of conversation is the EDS Center at Mount Sinai, which is new and fantastic.
It is. It's really exciting, actually. It's exciting to sort of bring this to another forum because, you know, we've been doing this for several years now. And so Mount Sinai South Nassau has been very supportive in allowing us to establish the EDS Center, which is a center that it focuses on patients with hypermobility type EDS and all of the comorbidities that come along with it. So the whole SEPTED patient that we often talk about, where there's things like hypermobility and mast cell activation and dysautonomia and small fiber neuropathy and chronic fatigue, lots of autoreactivity often. And then very often these patients have cranial cervical instability from just their ligamentous laxity. And that creates a sort of a set of symptoms of its own just from the unstable cranial cervical joint with compression of the lower medulla, some compression of the vessels within the neck. So our goal at the EDS Center is to really address this from a whole system perspective and try to connect the dots, because all these patients present with these different diagnoses. And so there's got to be a core root to the problem. And that's what our goal is, and to help patients really understand their bodies and help treat and manage them appropriately. And what's interesting about this center is that there are three different branches. And I think that's what makes this really unique and an exciting opportunity. And there's a clinical branch, and I'm the medical director of that. But the notorious Dr. Ann Maitland is joining me, who is the premier mast cell expert of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a surgical branch, which is directed by Dr. Paolo Bolognese. Mm-hmm. And he is very well known for cranial cervical fusions and for detethering of tethered cords. The third arm is actually a research arm, which is really exciting. And so, and we have a jackpot research team that we've hired, and we are addressing all kinds of questions in these patient populations. And what's really nice is that, you know, we don't sit in silos, the medical, surgical, and research teams. We really feed into one another, and we contribute data, and we have dialogue that poses questions that we want to answer, and we can try to answer them through research and through clinical evaluations. And so we really work very closely together in a collaboration and trying to better understand these patients and better further the knowledge that we have for patients with hypermobility type EDS and all the things that come along with it.
Why this population? What's up with this population?
I think this population is not well understood, and I think they haven't been well understood for a very long period of time. And so they'll often present even earlier on, you know, with a particular symptom that, you know, testing is often normal, or at least the conventional testing is often normal. And I think a lot of physicians don't really understand these patients and sort of what a connective tissue disorder can ultimately do and present as. And so, you know, a lot of these patients come with stories that, you know, their doctor's visits in the past have been, you know, somewhat unhelpful. Occasionally they're dismissed. You know, they're often told that it's psychosomatic or a conversion disorder. And so we hear that story regularly. And I think it's just largely because, I mean, it's not well understood. It's, you know, we need to elucidate more about this. We need to understand more. And that's why I think more research needs to be a part of what all clinicians do. There mm-hmm. needs to be some research that is supporting the clinical evaluations of patients and the clinical management of patients. And that's what's important. I think that's why this EDS center, it's like a home for these patients who have, for the most part, been sick for many, many years. And their stories are such that it's chronic and it's progressive. And, you know, if early on they have a diagnosis of POTS and maybe not yet NASL activation, eventually they do. It seems that this septad of diagnoses presents itself at some point during this journey. And so in some ways that sometimes helps us have an idea of what we need to be on surveillance for, or what we could be preemptive about or prophylactic about, you know, what we could, you know, sort of guide and counsel patients on. And, you know, it's a home where they feel like they're understood, that their symptoms are acknowledged, that their symptoms are validated. And I think that's really important for a lot of patients who feel like a lot of their symptoms haven't been validated. And these are the kinds of symptoms that change quality of lives, you know, tremendously, as we know, right? So, you know, patients were highly functioning. They were often, you know, very successful in physical endeavors and academic endeavors and occupational endeavors. And then all of a sudden they can no longer perform. And that's very obviously distressing to the patient and their families. And so it's nice when we can validate what they've been experiencing and then work towards understanding more about what their pathophysiology is and finding more tailored and personalized treatment methods for them. Mm-hmm. So it's a real exciting place in that regard. And I'm just happy that Mount Sinai South Nassau has been so supportive of the center of Dr. Bolanice and I. And it's just, there's really exciting things to come. We have a lot of plans. We're talking to a lot of other well-known physicians in the who really focus in on EDS patients with hypermobility, so that we have basically the best team available, mm-hmm. you know, in one house mm-hmm. for these patients.
And so if a patient listening or if a person listening to this feels like, maybe that's me, what do they do next?
Well, they could call and schedule an appointment, of course. That's usually the easiest way to do mm-hmm. it. I mean, I will say that obviously we do a lot of that kind of work here. And so mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, it even depends upon where a patient is located. I am doing telemedicine from Mount Sinai South Nassau at the moment. So that also makes it a little bit easier for mm-hmm. patients to make an appointment as well. So that really is the first step. They can reach out to Mount Sinai South Nassau and find out how they can schedule an appointment. And usually the first step is scheduling an appointment in the more of the medical branch, the clinical branch with mm-hmm. either me or Dr. Maitland. And then, you know, we do an evaluation and it's, you know, for example, cranial cervical instability is thought to be a very major component to their presentation. Then they're evaluated, you know, more definitively for that and then referred to Dr. Bolanice. If we find that there are other things that should be, you know, managed first in terms mm-hmm. of other diagnoses or other symptoms, then we work on that together to make them more of a surgical candidate to have more confidence that there will be a good post-op response and, mm-hmm. and a recovery plan. And so that is the first step to make an appointment.
And what kind of tools do you have for like evaluation and treatment through Mount Sinai?
So we do a lot of labs, of course, mm-hmm. and a lot of imaging. We do some specialized panels. A lot of what we do here, we don't yet have autonomic testing. We do hope to in the future, but we have that here in our clinic in Seattle. But we do skin biopsies and muscle biopsies and lumbar punctures and EMGs. We have basically everything at our disposal other than autonomic testing at this moment in time. Mm-hmm. But we hope to get that in the near future.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Talk to me about connective tissue, because that's at the root, you know, when we think about these, like the septad, the seven trunks of the different trees of mast cell and gut and SIBO and gastroparesis and dysautonomia and chronic infections, et cetera. you know, that root is really neuroinflammation. And we talk about a lot of that coming out of the connective tissue. Why? Talk to us about connective tissue.
Yeah, I think one of the holy grails of this patient population is really what's gone wrong with their connective tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is an EDS variant that we don't know the genetic variant for, right? So usually the EDS panel, which looks for the other subtypes that we know the genetics for, is often negative. Occasionally, we find the variant of uncertain significance in one of the collagen genes, but for the most part, they're negative. So what is really going on with the connective tissue in these patients is really the question that we hope to answer. Why is the architectural integrity of the connective tissue so poor?
What
happens to the matrix? Why does it break down? Well,
why?
One of the studies that we actually have underway right now, which is real exciting, is to Dr. Bolognese actually collects tissue samples from the ligaments when he does the craniocervical fusion, and he's also taking a piece of the C2 nerve root. And as well as I'm doing skin biopsies, and that's also being included in the study. But we're in a collaboration with a company called PolyBio, and so we are looking at infectious organisms of this tissue.
Ooh.
Because one of the theories is there an infectious process underway that's sort of breaking down the connective tissue, basically, so that it's structurally, it's not as sound and it's a lot more lax. And so we're looking at infectious etiologies. There are other theories. And, you know, obviously one of the things that we want to understand are more histological parameters. So what is the problem with the matrix specifically, histologically? Mm-hmm. What do we see under the microscope? And then if we can identify organisms of which we're actually doing next generation sequencing. So we're actually looking for genomes of bacterium and viruses and so on. And so we hope to be able to identify that there perhaps is an infectious reason behind it. If not, you know, there's also inflammatory histological markers that you can see under a microscope. And so we hope to learn a lot more about the connective tissue in these particular patients, because they're actually being harvested from patients who have cranial cervical instability and are, you know, more often than not, the septad type patient. And so they are presenting as a septad patient does, and these are their tissues.
Hmm.
And so we really hope to glean a lot of information and understanding more about what is happening in the connective tissue and hopefully why. And the more we know about what and why, the more we can better treat and hopefully find better solutions to, you know, to fix the connective tissue. I mean, that's sort of always what we struggle with, right?
Yeah.
We sit in front of a patient who has all these problems because the connective tissue, which holds our bodies up and holds our bodies together, basically all of our organs and our skeletal, you know, body.
And like our vessels.
Everything.
Like, and our
everything,
gut lining.
Everywhere.
Our leaky gut and our leaky brain.
Everything is leaking because the connective tissue is not tight, right? So we just sort of look at them and like, you can't help but think, how do I fix your connective tissue? Mm-hmm. You know, we can fix your mast cell activation, or at least we could, you know, manage it. We can manage your POTS. You know, we can manage even any kind of SIBO or leaky gut. We have those tools at our disposal. But how do we fix the core root? How do we fix the connective tissue? Right. So there's a lot of work into how we can fix it. And we, you know, we do a lot of regenerative kind of medicine, and that has been helpful to some extent, though it's clearly not the whole mm-hmm. answer. And so if we can understand why does the connective tissue break down?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that there's at least a genetic component as well as some exposure component, because I think that, you know, I think most of these patients are, you know, have a history of, you know, being flexible their whole lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were born with a genetic vulnerability to ligamentous laxity, and then some exposure, which goes, you know, back to my research in environmental exposures, sometimes plays a role. Because what exposure was it? Was it infection, which a lot of people think it is? And, you know, I don't disagree, but maybe it's other things as well for some people. Maybe it's both, you know, or was it an environmental contaminant, an environmental toxin? Was it something, you know, where you live, is something in the air and the water and the food is sort of the second hit, you know, so you're born with a vulnerability and then something just puts it over the edge, you know, mm-hmm. with the straw that broke the camel's back.
Mm-hmm.
There's another kind of metaphor that I can't think of. Right.
There's an Ayurvedic, I used to remember the Sanskrit word for the medical analogy of the straw that broke the camel's back, like the cigarette that gives you lung cancer, there's actually a word for like what tips the scales.
What's that word?
I can't remember. It's long. I think it starts with a U, but I can't remember what it is.
Okay.
But it's a concept that they've talked about, you know, for thousands of years about
right.
that things accumulate and then the change happens.
Well, that is exactly how it works. I have had many patients, you know, in the past who have a diagnosis and not a very good one. And they'll say things to me like, I don't understand. I was, really healthy. Mm-hmm. I lived a good life. I took care of myself. Mm-hmm. And how can this happen to me? And I always say, well, you're sick. You're well until you're sick, right? Yeah. You're well. And then all of a sudden you're sick. And I do believe that there's something that just sort of broke the camel's back. So I can come up with but it is true.
The load is too heavy.
The load becomes too heavy at some point, right? Mm-hmm. And it just can't take anymore. And I used to, like when I opened up this practice several years ago, I used to talk about how, our health sort of sits in this window. Mm-hmm. And, we can go, anywhere in that window. We might not be in complete balance, but if we're somewhere in the window, then our bodies have a sort of a natural ability to find its way back to the middle of the window. But if once we sort of fall off the sill a little bit or mm-hmm. go out of the window pane, then it becomes a little bit too much for the body and it doesn't know how to find its way back.
Yes.
And so, I really do think that at some point our bodies just sort of say, okay, enough. Mm-hmm. I give up. Wave the white flag.
And that's when things like metals or pollution or Epstein-Barr viruses or infectious disease, like it's not necessarily just the infectious organism. It's also the terrain and the tolerance and the susceptibility of the individual.
Absolutely.
So looking for microorganisms, it's not just about the microorganism, but it's also about like what your tissue does with that. And
that's exactly right.
As soon as you were saying that, I just kept thinking about like how soft and moldy peach gets,
right.
Because it's like there's a mycotoxin there and then the whole thing just turns to mush. And
that's exactly right.
It's kind of like what's happened in our tissues.
That's right. That's a good analogy.
It's a sad analogy.
It's a sad analogy. It's true. But when you think about some, like take Lyme, for example, Borrelia, mm-hmm. I mean, it's known to really sit in tissues. And yet we do a lot of blood work, a lot of, as some people call the liquid biopsy,
right?
Which I think is a little clever. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of liquid biopsies looking for these organisms. And, oftentimes you find evidence of it, but they really sit in our tissues. So is that playing a role? I know tick-borne infections are somewhat controversial, but I think, gaining some steam in some mainstream circles. And it's certainly one of the organisms that our study is looking for, but they are known to sit in tissues. So you're right. I think that something causes the tissues just to break down.
It's like you're constantly having to fix your house. And if you get really distracted, then you start hammering away from where the nail is and suddenly the structure isn't sound anymore.
Right.
And we've talked in this clinic, when we treat patients, the one thing that we have at our disposal is how to decrease inflammation, which we can do fairly well, and the regenerative piece. And for that, we use all of our tools. We use the hyperbaric oxygen mm-hmm. and the VASPR. VASPR is excellent.
Oh, it's incredible.
At regenerative
medicine. It's probably my number one favorite treatment for neuroinflammation, mm-hmm. but it has to be done regularly. So it's often, obviously, not a realistic treatment plan for a lot of patients.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. We use everything at our disposal. Obviously, I hope to bring all of that to Mount Sinai South Nassau at some point. But here I think we specialize in basically neuroinflammatory responses.
Yeah.
And there's a lot that can be done. And it's not just about a medication. And it's not just about pharmaceuticals. And while we use those as well, because as I was saying, sometimes we're so far out of the window mm-hmm. that we really need something aggressive to sort of bring us back closer. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's the multifactorial kind of approach that really is ultimately the most beneficial to patients. And so that's what I talk a lot about with patients here, patients there. I think that's the key. And I think we need to bring this more to the mainstream. And I think, mm-hmm. What's exciting is sort of plans to educate not only patients, but also other physicians and trying mm-hmm. to get people to understand this complex presentation and how best we can really manage and treat these symptoms.
Yeah. And a lot of it is certainly listening to the patient. So that's certainly mm-hmm. something that you excel at and you're going to be doing in any place you talk to a patient, and Dr. Maitland too.
Absolutely.
So how you listen to patients, I think, is different than a lot of us have been trained under the medical model. You're not listening for a diagnosis in terms to treat. You're listening for triggers and response.
Very true. Very true. I mean, a lot of patients already come with diagnoses, as you know. So it's just sort mm-hmm. of something, in their intake forms, you have these diagnoses. But I think what's important is to sort of listen to the patient in terms of what their life has been like mm-hmm. and what their symptoms have, how their symptoms have affected that life mm-hmm. and not necessarily how their diagnosis has affected them. It's really how the symptoms, because the truth is that the same diagnosis can present in different ways in different patients,
right.
So really to me, when I talk to patients, and I think sometimes patients are shocked that I have them tell me their story, even mm-hmm. though, they've sent me forms and I have documents and I have records, but there's something about when the patient tells you their story, mm-hmm. from their own words, mm-hmm. and I look at their face, you know, even when it's just a televideo appointment or when they're actually here in the clinic in front of me, you know, watching them tell me this story means a whole lot more to me than mm-hmm. reading, you know, on paper. I appreciate the records, of course, because it always helps me when mm-hmm. I have to go back and sort of refresh, like, did they have this done? Was mm-hmm. this tested? Was this looked for? Just hearing their story means a lot to me, actually. So
yeah,
I think sometimes, you know, patients are like, oh, but I sent you all the records, and I say, I know, and I read them, but I want to hear it from you now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even when they're referred by other doctors, they say, didn't, you know, Dr. So-and-so tell, yes, they did, but I want to hear it from you now. I think we're lucky in the sense that we have the time to yeah. give to patients mm-hmm. to allow them to tell their story, because, you know, their story is their story. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard for them to just sort of say it in 15 minutes, right? Because it's their story.
Yeah.
I have a hard time telling my story in 15 minutes. Yeah. I mean, I can't do it in 15 minutes. No. It's my story.
Yeah.
And your story would be hard, yeah. you know? So I think that it's nice to have a luxury of time, which I think is a problem with the current medical model, which Absolutely. Is that, you know, doctors just don't have the time. And it's a shame, because I think we're missing out on a lot of patients and their lives. And that's really ultimately what their health is about.
I think that's the thing that feeds us as clinicians, is being able to listen to patients and being able to be part of the story. And so yes. I think there's nothing that gets you quicker to burnout than having to rush through a patient's story.
Oh, for sure.
I was looking at something from Gabor Mate the other day, who does a lot of trauma work. And he was saying, you know, children, trauma isn't created when children go through hard times. It's when they go through hard times and feel alone going through
yes.
them. And so I think that having, when I listen for the story, just as you're saying, you know, you can have a patient who lost a parent to a car accident at 6, and that might still be as traumatic as the day it happened, or it might have been that they were surrounded by a hive of people who mm-hmm. loved on them and hugged them. And maybe that was a place in which they grew and got to feel supported even through a hard time. You know, it's not the raw data of our lives that gives our lives meaning and that informs our nervous system how to function.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we should shift into that feed and breathe or rest and digest parasympathetic state or into that fight or flight sympathetic state,
right.
you know, it's really about how we perceive it. And, you know, are we alone or are we held?
Absolutely. If we feel that if we fall, someone's there to catch us, it makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
That is very, very true. And it doesn't have to be a lot of people. It actually could be just one.
Yes.
You know, if you know that you have that one person that mm-hmm. has your back, that sort of changes your outlook on life, because you know you can go forward and there's someone at least in your corner.
Yeah.
And that makes people feel safe.
Yeah.
You know, we often talk about the cell danger response,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's obviously on a microscopic cellular level that we talk mm-hmm. about. But if you think about what happens is the cells hunker down and they don't talk to their neighboring cells.
That's exactly right. And they cut off communication.
Right. And then the organ doesn't work.
Yes.
Right. Because it doesn't have the optimal biomass. We talk yeah. about this all the time.
Yeah.
That's another podcast, by the way, we should talk about.
We should.
But it's the exact same thing for the macroorganism, right? Mm-hmm. So for us as humans, mm-hmm. like if we don't talk to, if we don't have people that we can reach out to and, mm-hmm. and hold hands with,
mm-hmm.
then we also don't work, mm-hmm. right? So, because we don't have our optimal biomass, which, you know, again, could just be one other person that you hold on tight with and they hold on tight to you.
Yeah.
And sometimes it could be more than, and sometimes it could be a whole village. But we need other people, certainly. And I agree with you. I think that tragedy happens to most people in life. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to get through a life without at least some sad events happening, mm-hmm. certainly. But if you have people in your
Except
corner,
all the people on Instagram, because life is,
the life is perfect,
perfect on Instagram.
That is very true.
The only traumas are the resolved traumas. Right. Wow, did I suffer, but now I am amazing.
Now I have blossomed.
Yes.
I've come out of the ashes.
And look how good these photos are.
That's true.
So in many ways, you know, what you're doing, you know, here and in South Nassau, what you're doing is revolutionary in a 3D matrix,
mm-hmm.
because you're not only pushing the boundaries of closing all those silos, bringing all these patients with these disparate diagnoses that, you know, if you look at with any one particular lens from a gastroenterology level or just a endocrinology level, you know, you can't see the picture. So that's one way in which you're pushing the boundaries. And then the other is really the tools and that you're using for diagnosis and treatment. And then the third way is really valuing and listening to the patient's story for how they apply their value.
Absolutely. You summarized it very, very well. I need say no more.
So that's amazing. And what's amazing is, you know, we have, if I can just wax poetic a little bit on kind of the story here, which is that you left mainstream medicine. I left mainstream medicine to do what we knew was the right thing to do, you know, and you left years ago, not knowing whether how the world would essentially catch you. And here is now the world and kind of standard big box medicine. I don't know how else to describe it. You know, corporate medicine, mm-hmm. the man, the medicine is essentially inviting you back in to do it the way that you did it standalone after leaving. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I suppose on some level that's true.
But I think that's great because the value is really being recognized.
Right. I think it's important for me to just sort of see myself as still, you know, independent.
You know, you're sitting in those seats, you're charting in that system, patients are seeing you through that system, and your worth and your value, the reason that they want you there so badly is because of the work you've been able to do independently.
Right. I don't believe that anyone is truly irreplaceable. So while I appreciate what you're saying, I don't think it's got to do only with me. Mm-hmm. I think that I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. I've worked with Dr. Bolognese for a while, and I think that he is a treasure in terms of for this patient population. What he does is nothing short of phenomenal. So I've worked with him for a while, and I just, like I said, I think I just got fortunate to be invited to be part of this incredible EDS center. And I'm grateful for it because I think it gives, you know, a lot of patients access to not only, you know, a center that's built for them, but also to the work that we do, you know, because we are obviously cash-based practice. Everyone knows that. And while, you know, we totally recognize that not everyone has access to us, it does allow some patients to have better access because it's under the auspices of Mount Sinai, which take, you know, insurances. So it allows for us to reach more patients, basically. Yeah. And so I like that part. It sits well with me because, you know, we both believe in, you know, equal access for all patients. But, you know, unfortunately, the medical model, the healthcare system doesn't really allow for private practice it's not that easy to be in private practice.
And especially in a clinical setting, because, you know, what's hard is that insurance does big reimbursement for surgeries. And so, and not as much for clinic.
Correct.
Like very like a minuscule teeny
clinic
tiny
visits, very small.
So even though most time should be spent in clinic visits to even prevent surgeries, you know, you have to have that balance.
And so absolutely.
The EDS center is brilliant in pairing surgery, clinical and research, because
that's right.
Those are all that means it can be supported. It can be sustainable. Mm-hmm. And you have your team. Dr. Maitland too was in private practice, cash-based practice, and has been drawn back in. Dr. Bolognese, of course, as a surgeon, was always in.
Right. You can't do surgeries.
In the clinic.
In the clinic.
Only teeny tiny ones.
Only teeny tiny.
Like skin biopsies, muscle biopsies. Okay. And so you've really got super top rated team.
And we're getting more. I mean, I've been talking to different surgeons, you know, orthopedic surgeons, vascular surgeons. Mount Sinai South Nassau has an incredible gastroenterology department, and they're super excited about what we do and are excited to be part of it. They have a great pathology department and they're excited to be part of it. So when I say support, I mean, it's coming from lots of different specialties, lots of different departments. I'm talking to, like I said, you know, other doctors elsewhere that will play a role, you know, at some point in some capacity, because we really are committed at trying to find, you know, all of the different disciplines that these patients need access to. And that really is our ultimate goal, as well as, like I said, the research to come out of it, because that's what's ultimately important for long-term care for these patients.
Yeah. Well, anything else that you want to share about the EDS Center?
Well, they are, there's a new building being built, not specifically for the EDS Center, but for other programs that Mount Sinai South Nassau is going to be having. And we will be part of that. So right now, the center, in terms of a physical location, is just in one of their clinics. I think when some people hear the EDS Center, they envision this, you know, very, you know, beautiful architectural, modern building.
Standalone.
Right, exactly. And that doesn't exist yet, but we will be in a very nice new building, probably in 2022 or 23. It's being built right now. But right now, the center is just taking place in one of the clinics, but we hope to have some grand space at some point in the future.
And the question we hear most often from patients is like, is Dr. Ruhoy leaving or is she staying? And so how would you answer that question?
I say that I'm bicoastal at the moment.
That's very progressive of you.
And so I fly back and forth, you know, but like I said, I do telemedicine for them, you know, even when I'm here in Seattle, and I fly there for a week at a time every, you know, month or so, and I'll continue doing that for the time being.
Yep. And you do telemedicine here from here in Seattle as well.
Yes. I do telemedicine for, and in clinic visits, obviously here in Seattle. And so, yes. So I do it all.
She's doing it all.
I do.
It's good. That's why, like, you know, that's why we're getting you scribe. Like, so
I can do it all as long as I can keep up.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you take great care of patients, and we've got a really good solid team here to help and support patients and support patient needs. And
yeah, I will say that I think that the team I have here in Seattle, mm-hmm. including you, or I should say especially you, have been real, been so supportive of me and my mm-hmm. work that actually allows me to feel comfortable to do this bi-coastal mm-hmm. work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's sort of worked out well in terms of, you know, how we work together and what we do here in our Seattle clinic for patients, which mm-hmm. we love doing. And I get excited to see patients every day. So, but I think it's been made easier just because of how well we work together, how well our clinic runs for the same patient population. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's worked out really well, and I'm just excited about the future.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, let me know when Mount Sinai is ready for Ayurveda.
I will. Oh, I'm working on it.
Thank you. Thanks for telling us what's going on and all about the center. And it's great to hear. And what a top-notch team. And we're glad for the update.
Anytime. I'll update you regularly.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay.
Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you all for listening today with Dr. Eileen Ruhoy. We've got lots of ways to continue this conversation through Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And you can get more information from and about us at our website, centerforhealingneurology.com, or at the EDS Center website, southnassau.org/SN/Chiari, which is Chiari-EDS. Be sure to share this show with your friends, and we welcome your rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. And feel free to send topic requests to podcasts@centerforhealingneurology.com. We love that you've joined us today to discuss how to make our whole world medicine. We rise or fall together, and we're committed to doing what we can to make as many of us as healthy as possible. And this takes all of us, including you. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
Party Fish Media acknowledges that it operates and records on Indigenous Duwamish and Puget Sound Coast Salish land that is still home to the Duwamish tribe. This land is stolen in violation of the Point Elliott Treaty of 1855. We are committed to uplifting the name of these lands and community members from these nations who reside alongside us. For more information on this land, its people, or ways you can help, visit duwamishtribe.org or realrentduwamish.org.